You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Tim Oppler, Brian Scorney, and Matt Gline. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So we've talked a lot about the extremely difficult market for public biotechs, with stocks not really reflecting positive catalysts in the way we'd expect. That's a more recent trend. What we haven't really seen before, though, is big pharma companies experiencing double-digit percentage drops in share price on a single day on earnings. So Sanofi last week lost, it was last Friday, right around the time that we were recording last week's episode, Sanofi lost $21 billion in market cap last Friday, or 19%, after it announced its plans to increase investments in R&D and spin out its consumer business. Tim, what were your thoughts on why Sanofi was down so much?
Yeah, you know, so we're in a very disorderly market. There, you know, in the background, I think things going on at sort of the fund level in our industry, and that's all related to sort of the kind of drip effects of, you know, the Fed sort of gradually tightening the macro environment. And so, you know, investors are very trigger happy on the downside and slow to acknowledge good news, unfortunately. And so Sanofi had what indeed is bad news, right? I mean, they basically indicated that kind of the growth expectations that analysts were looking for in the future were not going to be hit. And yet, you know, that news wouldn't normally have justified a 20% drop in their stock. I'm not sure I've seen a big pharma drop by 20% in one day. Maybe like Merck on the Biox news or something. I don't know. You'd have to go way, way back to look. And so, you know, I think Sanofi was, you know, trying to put some good news out. They were going to spin off consumer, and it all just kind of looked like they were sort of papering over some bad news. And, you know, every once in a while you'll see a company do that. So like, remember when SVB disclosed that they had bad news, they really did have bad news, like catastrophic bad news. And they were, you know, trying to make it sound positive. Josh, you've talked a lot in the past about companies that try to turn something bad into something positive. And so Sanofi did that, right? I mean, the press release was like leading off with, this is the play to win strategy. And I think it just set investors off kind of in the wrong week with the wrong news. I'd love to hear what others think.
Yeah, you also have to wonder, I mean, with these kind of such dramatic stock reactions, like how much of it might be driven by trading algorithms. The stock did kind of recover. There were some highlights, like the Beyfortus launch and probably a broader theme for the industry, RSV product launches were one of the big themes of this week. Just numbers across the board, just exceptionally strong out of the gate. So I think that unfortunately got masked by a number of the other issues. That is a product that they share with both, I believe, Astra and Sobi. Yeah, but frustrating to see that kind of a move as dramatic as it was. You kind of have to wonder why exactly it happened as to the extent it did.
Yeah, and it brings us more broadly to other pharma and big biotech companies that are down quite a lot in the last year. Actually, if you look from November 2022 to November 2023, Sanofi's only off about 2.5%. Pfizer, on the other hand, is down about 39%, BMS 36%, Roche is off 23%, Biogen 21%, and AbbVie 11%. On the other hand, the pharmas developing GLP-1s are up big. Lilly's up 58% and Novo's up 87% in the same period. Brian, I'd love to hear your thoughts on pharma performance more broadly.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's a lot of factors going on. I mean, certainly I think when you look at a lot of these big pharma names, right? There's sort of a tendency of a lot of investors to kind of play some themes, right? So, you know, 3 years ago, the themes were COVID, right? So if you're a vaccine or anti-viral maker, you really got this big boost from the COVID concerns and ability to compete for, you know, this really, really big market. And you know, investors are generally looking for growth. So as that unwinds, I think you see the investment in that unwind too. Pfizer is sort of the leading indicator of that. And you know, now the theme is sort of the GLP-1s and obviously Novo and Lilly, and with the rapid emergence of those products in obesity, people are playing those themes. You know, I think also you see big moves on both of these names on either direction, right? Pfizer down 40%. I mean, Lilly up a dramatic multiple from a number of years ago. And you know, I think sometimes you could see a lot of volatility around these names more so than historically. And I think that's a function of sort of the general market. We talk a lot with investors about, you know, this concept of these names being used to some extent as cash proxies. I think a lot of the, you know, despite the way the market has performed, you know, we're not that far from all-time highs, right? I mean, we're, you know, only about 10% off all-time highs. And yet I think there's a level of fear out there that doesn't reflect, you know, what people's outward enthusiasm is for some of the stocks. So there's this tendency to trade down really quickly when there's the concern that things aren't very safe. And, you know, I think that's part of the problem with these large caps is, you know, we are facing IRA coming and impacting the sector in a couple of years. The reputation of pharma, you know, is sort of at an all-time low. And a lot of these big companies, they don't have near-term product launches to kind of drive growth. So I think when you see the potential for declines in a year or two, we've certainly seen the unwind of a company with declining sales. You know, if you can't grow, I think there's a very, very rapid investor sentiment to try to sell out of a company. And that's why you see these big down moves, in my opinion.
It's also just broadly a reminder that getting that macro call of money flowing from one sector to another is often as important, if not more important, than individual stock picking within a sector.
Yeah.
So Matt, last month Pfizer disclosed company-wide program to cut $3.5 billion in costs, and then this week they announced staffing cuts, and they're closing a handful of sites in New Jersey and North Carolina. Love to get your thoughts on that, and then also Roche vis-a-vis the deal that you just announced, and more thoughts on that deal. Actually, we talked about it last week, but would love to get your perspective.
Yeah, thanks. I was going to say you guys were talking about me behind my back. Are talking about us behind our back anyway last week. I guess I'll just add that we also have opinions on wild moves in the stock that maybe aren't what the company who disclosed the news expected, just based on how the last couple of weeks have gone for us. But, you know, it's a wild market out there. So part of it's probably just with the sector in flux, people are moving faster and asking questions later. You know, in terms of, I feel like in terms of the big pharma guys, in some ways we have a unique seat where we have been involved in helping on both sides, right? Obviously the asset that we picked up from Pfizer, which in some ways was a leading indicator for what Pfizer knew they were going to have to do, which is to work on their business and focus on, you know, the roll off of the COVID product line and so on. And I think that's why fundamentally they made the TL1A available to us last year. And I think Roche has its own growth story that it needs to work on. And I think that's why the transaction was available to us in the other direction. And so I think, you know, we're constantly talking to these big pharma companies. And I guess what I'd say is, like, I just think there's a major sort of cataclysmic set of changes happening in basically all of these companies at this point. And in some ways, I think the market reaction is like a tip of the iceberg, like slight visible sliver of just how big the reorientations are, where people are like shifting product lines, shifting therapeutic categories, people who have had no immunology business for a long time are getting into immunology, people are changing the way they think about R&D. And I think like all of this is happening against a backdrop of like trying to manufacture their growth story for the next decade. And look, obviously for Roivant, this is an opportunity market for us where we can go and take advantage of that by finding things that don't fit in the version of that story any given company is trying to tell. But more generally, I think it's something that we've seen happening for a year, and my suspicion is it's going to be happening for another year or more, just as everyone kind of tries to sort out the various pipeline issues. So it's been interesting to watch. I'm sure there will be lots of market moves in lots of different directions as it plays out. But I think fundamentally, everyone feels like they've got to sort through the story, and the story's changing for basically every big pharma company right now, one direction or another.
Hey, Matt, you touched on the reaction of your stock to the news last week. Did you want to say more about that?
it's been talked about in various places. Look, I think we're probably a little bit surprised, but it was a major part. To be honest, I think it's similar to what's going on in Big Pharma in the sense that, like, it was a major change to our story. It was a program that a lot of investors were excited about. We were excited about. We obviously got a sort of transformational amount of value for it in a short period of time. But that doesn't change the fact that if you came to our story last summer, or this summer, I should say, like 100% focused on TL1A, that when you woke up in the morning and the program was out, you know, especially in this tape, I feel like there were some shareholders who were like, yeah, I gotta act now and ask questions later. And then I think the other piece is, bluntly, I think a lot of investors are trying to sort out their year, having had a tough one. And I think, you know, for right or for wrong, I think people are trying to sit in names where there's like an M&A catalyst on the table or something like that. And I think people probably viewed the sale of the TL1A as an indication Roivant as a whole was unlikely to be bought by December 31st. And so they could step away for now and revisit in January and focus their attentions elsewhere. So I think all of those things are probably factors that applied. I will say,
Matt, just one follow-up on that.
Sure.
Last week, Brad, I think it was, mentioned that he thought that some investors might be wondering whether you'd consider doing a special dividend or somehow otherwise returning some of that cash to investors. Is that something that you've talked about publicly? Is that something you feel comfortable commenting on?
It's the question that I'm answering most often now. And we got it. I don't know if anybody listened to the call that we did when we announced the deal. We got it about six different ways on that call as well. Look, I think what I was going to say, which then gets to this point, is it stings a little bit to be trading at this deep a discount at this point to like our cash plus our Immunovant stake, because it sort of implies that the market thinks we are not going to be efficient stewards of the cash. And I guess I would have hoped that the deal we just did was evidence that we could be at least like somewhat responsible at generating value from capital. I think the answer is like, we're going to be thoughtful. I think the answer is we're going to be disciplined. I think the answer is this is a market that demands a lot of patience and thoughtfulness in making a decision on capital return. Because if the market continues to be choppy, once that money's out the door, it's never coming back. And so figuring out the right amount to allocate to our existing pipeline, the right amount to leave in reserve for a really exciting BD environment and the right amount to return to shareholders is just something I think we're going to take a little bit of time on. But you look at, and this is a, everyone I get on the phone with now tells me how unprecedented it is for biotech companies to return capital to shareholders and then asks me when I'm going to do it. So, you know, I think we're just going through that now.
Matt, you're,
you know, Matt, go ahead.
You're working with the assumption that the markets are efficient, which they never really are. And I'd argue this is one of the most inefficient market dynamics I've seen in biotech, which makes it actually one of the most attractive opportunities to be a biotech investor now, because you know, over time inefficiencies, they never quite fully correct themselves, but they do tend to normalize. Now I'd love to hear a little bit of the backstory in terms of how this transaction, you know, came together over what period of time. You know, were you working on this one? And obviously, congrats on such an amazing deal.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. I mean, I've said a little bit about this publicly, and it's been written about in other places. I mean, we in-licensed the program, acquired the program from Pfizer back in November of last year, December of last year, I think. Believe it or not, that was a pretty different moment in the TL1A world, right? It was before anybody had put out data. We didn't know what Prometheus' data was going to look like. We only knew a little bit of what ours was going to look like. We had the long-term data coming, and obviously no one knew what the M&A marketplace for TL1As was going to look like on the back of all of that. And so, you know, I think Pfizer did the deal for the reasons I've talked about here and have been widely written about. You know, I think basically as soon as the Prometheus data came out and the market rallied behind that story, and then we put out our own data, I think it became clear that these seismic shifts in big pharma, what I was talking about before, meant that there were just a whole bunch of people interested in doubling down on I&I. And so we had been planning to meet with Roche, or trying to meet with Roche is probably the right answer, just like to talk as companies, not about this program in particular. And to be honest, the feedback we had gotten from them was like, basically, we feel like we've caught up recently. We don't have anything to talk about. And then we put out the TL1A data. And we set up a meeting, and the person I was going to meet with agreed. And I thought it was going to be like a one-on-one meeting. And this was at JP Morgan last year in January. And I showed up and there were 13 or 14 people from Roche and me. It was like a 13-on-1, or maybe one other person from my team was there. But so that was probably the first indication that Roche was getting excited about TL1A. That was what they wanted to talk about. There were, I don't know, probably more than my lifetime and years of experience from GI docs and things like that in the room. And to be honest, from that point on, we took all of those conversations seriously. They were certainly not the only people that called. They were not the only people we had serious discussions with. And our view, which I've said publicly in multiple places, was my hope was to keep this opportunity available for as long as possible so that we could understand what the capital markets were going to be like, so that we could understand what our other programs were going to be like. Obviously, we now know that we have what we hoped for in 1402 in Immunovant. We think it has the potential to be a real best-in-class FcRn. That's the kind of information that we were really hoping to get. And basically, Roche effectively called the question on us last week and said it's now or never. And we looked at the opportunity and we looked at what it meant for us from a capital perspective, what it meant for our future, and frankly, what the markets look like. And we decided it was the right thing for us to do.
Tim, did you have a comment?
Yeah, just a comment. I mean, Matt, I completely agree with you on the stock price. It makes no sense. Like, the market's not just assuming your pipeline is worthless, but that you are going to, you know, destroy tremendous amounts of value. And last time I learned, you guys are called Roivant, you know, for ROI. So there's one company that's not going to waste money. It's probably you. Two things I've noticed are, you know, other companies are announcing return capital. Like this week, MEI Pharma announced a capital return. Their stock just barely moved. And so I think what you're really looking at is, you know, second, just a very disordered market. And, you know, Josh, you've commented on the inefficiency of the market. And, you know, what's going on is only going to become effectively looking at a number of funds that are, you know, either in shutdown mode or getting near shutdown mode. You know, most biotech hedge funds are down. That shouldn't be surprising, right? We just went through a brutal 60-day period. And, you know, I saw some data at the end of August. You know, I think at the end of August for a sample of 23 hedge funds, like there were four that were up for the year, right? So, you know, throw September and October on top of that, and you can just imagine what's going on out there. So normally you would see, you know, capital that can be reallocated and people are willing to take risks. And I think Brian and Josh, you both sort of said people are just kind of going home right now and hoping for a better day. So it's a very challenging moment in the history of our industry and the public capital markets.
I will say it's the first time that I've ever been able to go to a bunch of investor meetings and not have somewhere in the back of my head that I need to raise capital from the people across the table from me. And that's a great feeling. I recommend that to everybody.
No, it's the other way around. They're trying to raise capital from you. When are you going to give us the money back? Right? I mean, it's insane.
It's just a different dynamic. Look, they're still obviously important partners to us, and we still want to understand their appetites and things like that. But it's just been a different moment.
Yeah. So let's move to some gene therapy related news this week. There's actually a few different gene therapy news items. Earlier this week, Sarepta announced their gene therapy for Duchenne muscular dystrophy failed to meet its primary endpoint. The FDA had previously granted accelerated approval for this therapy, but only for 4 and 5 year olds. Although it missed its primary endpoint, Sarepta said it still intends to ask the FDA for an update to broaden the label, the approval to remove age restrictions. And interestingly, to the point discussed earlier, somewhat surprisingly, they called the trial a massive win. Brian and Josh, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I followed Sarepta. I've been following it for 10 years, and it's been just as controversial for the last 10 years as it is today. It's a really tough outcome for DMD kids and parents and families. I think there's a lot of hope that you know, you would see a massive effect. Certainly there's anecdotes out there of how great kids have been immediately after getting this gene therapy. And certainly that was not manifest in the study. It failed the primary endpoint, NSAA. Which it had failed in its phase two as well. But, you know, they sort of looked at the secondary endpoints and you know, the first secondary endpoint in the hierarchy, time to rise, showed a p-value well below 0.05, 0.0025, and, you know, a number of other secondaries hit a p-value below that threshold. But, of course, statistically, you know, I would argue that those become exploratory analyses because the primary failed. I think Sarepta would have another argument there. And, you know, they certainly claimed, at least publicly, that this was a big win. Look, I mean, this company has had a very close history with the FDA, going back to the Eteplirsen days. And, you know, they definitely have the ear of FDA leadership. And, you know, they have intimated to the market that they met with the FDA before they released the data to the public. So the FDA was aware of the data going into Monday. And, you know, they claim to have the support of the leadership to file to expand the label. Now, this was approved under a lot of controversy, and the review division of the FDA was very critical of the initial accelerated approval efforts. And there was a panel in the spring where the review division was very critical. And, you know, I think what Sarepta was asking for in terms of label and even what leadership was thinking in terms of label wound up being narrowed to just this 4 to 5 year old label. So I think there's a lot of questions as to what happens here. And it's a big debate as to what the FDA should do and what the FDA will do. I personally think it's going to be very hard to pull the application off the market. And I think this is, you know, one of the struggles that the FDA has to deal with. What is the threshold for pulling a drug off the market? Should it be different than what is the threshold for approving a drug? You know, when you look at a forest plot here, it's very compelling to parents where every single subgroup and endpoint favors treatment, even though a lot of those 95% confidence intervals overlap with zero. But I think that is, you know, you really are going to be in a very tough situation from the FDA standpoint, where if they were to try to pull it, I think you would get such a massive pushback from the DMD families and advocacy groups. I think it's really hard. So the question is, will the FDA expand it at all? And I think this is a very debatable topic too. We'll see. I personally find the time to rise pretty compelling. If you look at the phase two and the phase three, the time to rise is perfectly replicated. Basically, the same difference was shown in both of these studies. And I kind of look at this not dissimilar to the beta amyloid space, in that, you know, I think we have this tendency to overestimate the upfront effect of a drug, particularly in a progressive neurodegenerative disease that takes 20 years to slowly debilitate and kill these patients. And I think what we've learned with beta amyloid is, right, we need longer studies, more patients to really manifest the disease modifying effect. And I think something similar here. I've been pushing Sarepta for years to do 2-year studies instead of 1-year studies, because I think the 1-year endpoint just may not be able to overcome the heterogeneity here. But it is going to continue to be a controversial story as they move through the FDA. I don't know, Josh, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, well summarized, Brian. Peter Marks at ASGCT a year ago basically kind of addressed peripherally this exact question, you know, what would happen if the trial like this missed? And his answer was they'd kind of look for any possible reason why the trial didn't fail, and by the sounds of it, kind of bend over backwards to keep the product on the market because they are believers in the technology and the potential to help patients. So I agree. Keeping it on the market seems like a fairly high probability. They had a very strong first quarter of launch, which was, you know, nice to see, because there are ongoing issues about some of these gene therapy launches, you know, particularly like Roctavian, that's been struggling to get off the ground. So it's very reassuring to see, you know, drugs that are in demand for addressing very high unmet medical needs have successful product launches. Very important for the industry. You know, just stepping back to me, you know, if you understand the biology of muscle diseases and dystrophin, you know, the data that everyone was relying on was a little bit incredulous. Hard to believe that this kind of a therapy would actually improve muscle function and power, which was where everyone was kind of anchoring, or at least to a meaningful degree, because this is a degenerative disease, and the gene therapy approach was basically designed to turn it into a less degenerative disease. And So some of those early signals that, you know, many were focused on as supportive evidence of how transformational the product was, not really congruent with the biology. And indeed, you did see the placebo arm improve as well. You know, a reminder of the need to focus on, you know, the appropriate endpoints, you know, in certain settings where endpoints may be noisier or prone to a placebo effect, the importance of having a control arm. You know, now we'll have to see, you know, whether there are any read-throughs from this program into the, you know, to the exon skipping platform. I think many would argue that there's not necessarily a clear and direct read-through, but you kind of have to wonder, you know, what the value of some of these products are, if even what was supposed to be a very potent gene therapy program for Duchenne's wasn't able to separate. To Brian's point, you know, a degenerative disease, maybe you just need more time to see that benefit. If you think about other degenerative diseases in the neurology space, like how long it takes to see a benefit in Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, et cetera. So, you know, a lot of question marks heading into this data set, and probably a lot more heading out of it.
Yeah, and as we know, IPOs have been rare, and gene therapy IPOs even more so. This morning, gene therapy company Lexeo Therapeutics raised $100 million in IPO, pricing shares actually under its proposed $13 to $15 range at 11. Last I looked before the show started, it was trading at $9.50 a share. Tim, I'd love to get your general thoughts on, you know, the equity markets, including IPOs and follow-ons. I know you guys did some analysis that's going to be coming out in your next report. And then Brian's thoughts on Lexeo specifically.
Great. Yeah, I mean, I think we're, as I said, the markets are in sort of a tough spot. So if you look at the IPO market, it was certainly alive last month, which is actually pretty miraculous. But nonetheless, IPO volume in general has been, you know, pretty low this year with a few exceptions. So, you know, think of like the Kenvue IPO from J&J as part of their spinoff. The follow-on market's actually been quite healthy all year. And the follow-on market has been consistently focused on sort of catalyst type driven financings, and investors have really done quite well by playing in, you know, some of those financings we've talked about, you know, these pipes and how they're set up in past calls. And so that market, even on October, was reasonably robust. And so, you know, I think if you look at past downturns in our market, you know, 2002, 2003, 2004, you know, there were essentially no IPOs, and you know, an incredible reduction in follow-on activity following, you know, the 2007 events. Sort of the same thing played out. So you know, I think we all sort of deserve credit for being in a sector that has a functioning market. I mean, the fact that this market has functioned that well, even through the events of October, I think it speaks very well of how things are working.
Lexeo is an interesting company. It doesn't necessarily fit the mold of some of the other.
Oh, you're breaking up, Josh. Can you repeat that?
Oh, sorry. I was just saying that Lexeo doesn't necessarily fit the mold of some of the IPOs we've seen this year in a very, very narrow IPO window where it tends to be a little bit more de-risked and later stage. But, you know, that said, they have some very interesting programs. They have couple of gene therapy programs targeting the heart, one for Friedreich's ataxia cardiomyopathy, one for PKP2 cardiomyopathy, which are not ultra rare, but rare cardiac diseases. And it does come on the heels of some encouraging data updates for AAV gene therapy for heart cardiac conditions, such as Rocket's Danon syndrome program and 4DMT's Fabry syndrome cardiac manifestation program. So we are starting to see early indications that cardiac targeting gene therapy can thrive. I think we're still kind of waiting for some of that evidence from maybe CNS targeting gene therapies or even inherited retinal disease gene therapies. So yeah, there's been a lot of advance in the gene therapy field, and so Lexeo is actually at the clinical stage for a couple of these programs, and they even do have some biopsy data from one of their Friedreich's ataxia patients that does show expression of frataxin. So you know, even though it doesn't quite necessarily fit the mold of the 2023 IPO class, shares are trading down as you've indicated. You know, it is an interesting story, and it's very different than the kind of IPOs that we were seeing back in the anything goes 2020, 2021 years. It'll be interesting to see, you know, as private companies struggle to finance themselves as well. You know, are we going to see, essentially a forcing of the IPO window open by private investors who just can't necessarily continue to fund these companies indefinitely, who are looking for some liquidity, who may be willing to push these companies into the public market, even knowing that they may price below the range, they might trade down after the IPO. But at the end of the day, like with perhaps limited opportunities, that liquidity may be really important. So I think we're all kind of watching and waiting to see what the 2024 IPO class is going to look like. There are a lot of very promising candidates still in the private world that are contemplating an IPO, and you know, hopefully as the market does stabilize. Historically, November is a great month for the broader tape and for biotech. You know, hopefully a little bit more stability may help open that window a little bit further.
I know these things get planned way in advance, but it's kind of a tough week for Lexeo specifically to hit the IPO window, just given the Sarepta news, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of comps out there. You know, I sort of came familiar with Lexeo because of the Friedrich's Ataxia program. I think that's what most investors really focused on. There's a lot of parallels between Friedrich's Ataxia and Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and obviously Reata had the big acquisition from Biogen earlier this year. Coming off of their approval of their drug Skyclarys. You know, I think the disappointment with Sarepta kind of bleeds into the level of enthusiasm to AAV. Lexeo is partnered with Sarepta on some of their programs as well. So it's, you know, it's kind of an unfortunate week on the heels of the Sarepta Embark data to try to get this type of story out that is early stage and has those parallels. But, you know, I've become friendly with the CEO, Nolan. We're actually part of a charitable organization that you guys are, a lot of you are probably familiar with. Nolan actually is the chairman of the LifeSide Cares New York chapter. And I'm on the board of advisors there. So I've kind of become friendly with him and certainly would recommend anyone in the New York area look into it. He does some great work.
I think there's an event next Thursday, if I'm not mistaken. So Brian, if you're there, I'll see you there.
All right, I will be there.
Is this the same?
One of our friends from Royalty Pharma's band is playing.
Oh, super. Is this the same Life Science Cares that Rob Perez?
It is. It absolutely is. So yeah, I mean, Rob is the founder and sort of runs the parent version of it. But they each, you know, there's chapters that have sprung up in each city, Boston obviously being the original one. But about a year and a half ago now, we started up on the New York version of it.
Yeah, it's great. So thanks for the shout out to Life Science Cares more broadly, but also Life Science Cares New York. That's much appreciated. So Josh, did you want to talk more about the interim phase one data announced by 4D Molecular Therapeutics this week?
Sure, yeah. So they gave us an update of their higher dose gene therapy for cystic fibrosis. This is an inhaled gene therapy, a novel AAV capsid, a little bit modified CFTR protein, but one that looks like it preserves the general efficacy of CFTR. What was so interesting is that they're hitting expression levels that are 450% above like normal healthy people, which, you know, the first question is that a problem? And from the preclinical data that they have, it doesn't sound like it should be that. Super high levels of CFTR expression can be tolerated. Now, the data is still early. It's still evolving. And, you know, it's often when you look at these very early data sets, even in a space like cystic fibrosis, which is it's clearly genetically determined, and you think it would be fairly straightforward looking at some of the data and discerning signals, you kind of quickly realize, and we learn this over and over and over again, especially with early data sets, that's always a little bit more nuanced than you might expect in terms of which endpoints you should be focused on, how much noise there might be in some of these endpoints, you know, what happens to patients over time. after gene therapy compared to what a natural history might suggest. So, you know, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, other than to say that, you know, there's some actually very interesting signals here of efficacy for patients followed out longer, potentially an impact on CF exacerbations. So overall, you know, again, we're in this space of gene therapy that, you know, I think a lot of investors have perhaps fatigued from seeing a lot of things tried and a lot of things fail. But we're also at a time where we're starting to see things really start to work as well. You know, so in some settings, more, you know, quite obviously, quite dramatically, in the case of 4D, still evolving, but in a very, very encouraging kind of way. So we're really learning the lessons, as happens with any new modality that's introduced. Like, we're, a lot of stuff gets tried, a bunch of stuff works, a bunch of stuff doesn't work. You reiterate and iterate towards more and more success, following what's worked and trying new things in the context where it doesn't work. So definitely one to keep an eye on. Also one to keep an eye on is gene therapy for wet AMD. 4D has a program there. Verum has a program there. Starting to also, again, see really interesting signals of activity. And that's in contrast to some of the gene therapy efforts for inherited retinal diseases, many of which have struggled, you know, again, just some of the underlying biology and challenges in discerning a signal when you've got a degenerative disease and, you know, you're trying to slow it. So those are a couple of programs that we're keeping an eye on that I think most investors have generally ignored, in part because there are a lot of different options now for treatment of wet AMD, and so still waiting to see where those might fit in. But I think there's some interesting signals starting to emerge that we're going to be keeping quote an eye on for the wet AMD gene therapy field as well.
Right. So, Tim, there were a few deals this week. Can you talk about AZ Selectus, $245 million collaboration? And also, I thought the Lilly Beam Verve deal was pretty interesting.
Absolutely. So AstraZeneca entered into a collaboration with Selectus for 10 different cell and gene therapy programs. And the result of the collaboration is that AstraZeneca will be handing over more than $100 million in both cash and equity investment to Selectus. Obviously, it's a great piece of news for Selectus because, after all, they're going after 25 genetic targets, so they have no, you know, shortage of programs. And so getting $25 million up front from AstraZeneca was very helpful. But what was interesting to me was AstraZeneca's $80 million equity investment. If you sort of think about it, you know, AstraZeneca knew the stock would take off. Indeed, it did. It went up massively on the news. So AstraZeneca actually, you know, almost made money like a hedge fund on the deal, which will help them, you know, fund the investments that they need to make and select this over time. So when you look at the transaction that took place with Beam, it's a little bit complicated, but also very interesting. So in this case, what had happened is Beam had opt-in rights on Verb's base editing programs for a variety of approaches in cardiovascular disease. So Lilly acquired those from Beam, and you might recall that Beam had recently announced that they were taking measures to extend their pipeline. So the company has, you know, been a real success story. I think company has raised a lot of capital. Into their credit, their CEO John Evans has sort of said, "Hey, we need to, you know, be smart. It might be a while before we raise money here." And so I think this was a both a fundraising move for Beam and also a value creation move. When you look at this deal, what you see is that Lilly also made an equity investment into Beam. And so, you know, Beam obviously did well on the news, and so Lilly's also in the black. We saw a deal the other day where, you know, Gilead did something quite similar with Assembly Biosciences, which is just way, way down in the dumps. And, you know, just to make a broad comment, investors are sort of chasing companies that have near-term, mid-stage or late-stage programs with events. And so what ends up happening is companies like Assembly or Selectus or Beam end up trading well below fair value of their programs. And so, you know, we're all hoping that pharma comes in and buys Beam or buys Selectus, but you don't need to, right? If you can find a company that's, you know, concerned about cash, you can simply say, "Hey, why don't I just buy your stock? And by the way, I'll license a bunch of your programs." So that's a big trend, I would say, in the last month. It's one in a way that is very concerning because, the old saying, why buy the cow if you can get the milk for free? Not that they got the milk for free here, but these deals in some ways are very favorable to the pharma companies involved.
I'll say I have had a similar, not exactly the same as the way Tim just put it, but a similar question, which is there's been a number, like over the past few months, there's been a handful of these deals where like some large company has invested in the equity of a biotech company as part of a partnership. I mean, obviously like a super extreme example was NVIDIA and Recursion. And there's just been like so much signal taken by the market apparently from the investment. And I've always wondered a little bit about that. Like, look, on the one hand, we did our deal with Sumitomo back in 2019. They owned a bunch of our stock as a consequence of that deal. Like, they've been a great shareholder. They're sticky. They're long-term. They're in it for the long haul. They're more or less cooperative and so on. And just like good partners to us. But on the other hand, like, I don't know, especially if it's a big pharma company, you have to kind of wonder what it means for the set of strategic options in the future. You have to kind of wonder what it means for that company's interest in doing something beyond, as Tim was just suggesting, beyond kind of making an incremental investment and doing a partnership. And it's capital on the balance sheet, but like unlike the upfront in a transaction, it's dilutive capital. And then it's just quote unquote, just another investor. And so I've been surprised, maybe not so much that like, look, it's a nice, if your Beam, it's a nice way to get some additional capital out of a deal. Maybe you had squeezed everything you could out of an upfront, but you looked at your balance sheet and you were like, the extra however many tens of millions of dollars is going to make a big difference. But I do often wonder why the market takes such positive signal from the equity investment piece of it as far as the reaction is concerned.
Yeah, it's a good point because it might not necessarily signal, I mean, it probably doesn't signal that company is going to get bought by the investor pharma, and it does limit, potentially limit options. I also like the deals that are creative deals. We talked a lot about the royalty type of deals. And then, Bluebird just announced that they've entered into an agreement to sell what would be its third priority review voucher in about a year. And these priority review vouchers go for about $100 million. This one is to Novartis, and it's subject to the approval of their gene therapy for sickle cell. Josh, what are your thoughts on this? And actually, I think it's a kind of an interesting thing. I mean, they're generating about $300 million from sale of these PRVs. It's not a bad business model, I guess, on some level.
Not at all. And some companies rely on these PRVs just to cover the upfront investments, especially for smaller unmet medical needs or large unmet medical needs, I should say, that affect a very small number of patients. What was interesting on this one is that I don't know if others have seen this before, but I've never seen a pre-PRV sale contingent on actually getting the PRV. We typically see them announced afterwards. I know for Bluebird, though, financing is a significant question for investors. So maybe they did want to get out a little bit ahead of that to remind investors that they do have this source of capital. Certainly makes sense to pre-sell. One other thing that I've wondered about, again, curious as to others' thoughts on this, is that we're starting to have a lot of PRV vouchers being issued and being transacted. And is that do we get to a point where the market for PRV vouchers becomes somewhat saturated? It doesn't seem like we're there yet. The selling price for these remains north of $100 million. But at some point, you have to wonder if the value starts to decline as the scarcity factor abates.
I've had a super similar question to that, Josh. We worked on a therapy prior to the Sumitomo deal for congenital aphthamia, complete DiGeorge anomaly, which Sumitomo then bought from us and sold the PRV. But so we spent a much time looking, and we wouldn't probably have been able to work on that therapy were it not for the PRV opportunity. But we spent a lot of time looking at the PRV market. And these things, like in the early days of PRVs, there was like a lot of price discovery. And I think I can remember deals as low as maybe 80. And then there were a couple that printed like really high. I forget the numbers, but like much higher than 100. And for the past couple of years, it's just been like, yeah, it's within 10% of $100 million is kind of where the market is. But I've often wondered about those market dynamics. And at this point, like there's a handful of banks that do this business, that if you have one, they'll sell it for you. If you want one, they'll buy one for you. And they know where they're all coming from and they know where they're all are. And it's just sort of an interesting dynamic. I also feel like the demand side of the PRV equation is a lot more complicated than most people think. Because like, when do you like, look, in theory, any big product benefits, it's like a 3 to 6 month benefit, basically. Any big product benefits. But the real benefit is like, if you're neck and neck with a competitor and it gets you to a little bit earlier, or it gets you to the same time when you would have been behind or whatever. And like, there just aren't that many moments where two drugs in the same class are launching within 3 to 6 months of each other. So I feel like other than that, it's like an NPV strategy or whatever. It's like an extra 3 months of earnings at peak discounted back to today. And you do wonder how that's going to move around. I also feel like a lot of the benefit is, yeah, it's peak sales discounted today. I would have thought interest rates would have relatively meaningfully affected people's modeled values of PRVs, but it looks like they haven't.
Yeah, and coming back to trends, there's been some, you know, I think movement around fund strategies. So there was some fund investment news out over the last few weeks. We talked about OrbiMed last week, and this week Abingworth announced a $365 million fund that it plans to spend co-developing new medicines through phase 3 trials and helping big pharma. You just see more of these strategy shifts or sort of new funds focused on strategies that take advantage of the current environment and the amount of biotechs trading below NAV that have advanced programs in development. This week, we also saw that Blue Owl Capital announced that they're acquiring funds managed by Cowen. So they're going to buy about $1 billion worth of assets across several funds. And, that was sort of intriguing. So we don't have that much time left. I know we wanted to talk about the AdCom for CRISPR Therapeutics and Vertex sickle cell therapy. And then also, Josh, you wanted to cover some of the competitive dynamics in the JAK inhibitor for myelofibrosis and the CEO change at BioMarin. Let's start with Vertex, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe I jump in on that, Daphne. So, this was interesting because this is really the first time, and I think this is the reason why the AdCom was called, but it's the first time we were looking at a CRISPR-based therapeutic getting approval. And obviously, this is a relatively new modality of treatment has really emerged over the last 10 years or so. And this is sort of the first shot at it. So I think that's why the AdCom was called, more than anything else, to just kind of discuss the long-term risks of, making a genetic change within a person. And, it was an interesting AdCom to listen to. I mean, it was something that Bob Califf has been talking about, one without really any voting questions. It was kind of like just a discussion of, hey, how do we really consider the risks here and evaluate and consider long-term potential off-target edits that are occurring, and has Vertex done enough to ensure that there aren't off-target edits that are occurring, and how secure can we be in that? I'm pretty sure, and it's pretty close to the PDUFA date, so there's some speculation that maybe it'll take a little more time than the PDUFA to make a determination as to what sort of monitoring the company needs to be doing here. But it was very clear everyone was pretty positive on the data and the opportunity here. It's interesting kind of that they're going sort of in head-to-head competition for this market with Bluebird. I think from the Vertex perspective, I think investors are sort of somewhat ambivalent about this. I think it's probably much more important to CRISPR specifically, and certainly any of the other CRISPR names, what ultimately happens here. But it's an interesting first look at how people are sort of evaluating the risks of genetic editing. This is an ex vivo therapy, as opposed to, what I think will be the ones coming before the FDA in the next few years, like Intellia, where it's more of an in vivo edit, and certainly they potentially carry more risk. So it'll be interesting to see how the FDA evolves and evaluates these types of therapies. Matt, I know you at Roivant, you guys have had a similar program in the sickle cell space. So I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, we had an ex vivo lentiviral gene therapy program in sickle cell that fell victim to our own capital allocation broadly, but in part, frankly, because of the CRISPR program, which has just looked so great from a clinical data perspective that it set a high bar. And I guess I'll say two things, and one in each direction. One is, I think the challenge with all these programs, and our program was designed to try and avoid this challenge, but again, just the clinical bar was really high, is I think the CRISPR program also requires like busulfan-based preconditioning, which is pretty challenging for those patients. It's a long stay in a clean room hospital and all these other things. So it's high risk of a bunch of bad side effects. But these are really sick patients. And one of the things that I think is like easy to lose in the moment around the therapeutic modality is it's just pretty cool that a effectively curative therapy for sickle cell is a second one at some level with the Bluebird program before it is sort of on the doorstep of approval. And I do think it's just like a really interesting disease and an interesting moment in the disease that we can now treat. I guess one of the things that I think is fascinating to a topic that's been discussed on and off, I'm sure here and in other places, is sickle cell is a highly prevalent disease in the U.S. and in other places. It's particularly prevalent in poorer people of color. It's a patient population that is, as a consequence, frankly, quite difficult for the medical system to reach. And in particular for therapies like this. And so, you know, I think one of the things that's going to be interesting to watch, Vertex, obviously incredibly talented with similar patient populations with similar diseases. You know, I think it's going to be really exciting just as like a fan of new medicines for diseases where people really need them to watch that play out and to figure out how our industry can benefit this population, because I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Interesting. There wasn't really a vote on this AdCom. I don't know what everyone else thinks, but I missed the votes. The votes are very helpful for kind of at least directionally guiding where the panel's heading, as opposed to having to sit and listen to every single comment and trying to glean exactly what way that session went.
Yeah, I don't know if Bob Califf's listening, but from the investor standpoint, we actually like the votes, so try to keep them around.
Exactly. Maybe we can do some of the other highlights of the week. This was kind of one of those very surprising, and albeit not surprising at all, announcements that J.J. Bien-Aimé stepping down from the CEO role of BioMarin after quite a long tenure there. And it's actually Alexander Hardy, who's the CEO of Genentech, who's going to be taking over that role. So that's very impressive person now in at the helm of BioMarin, as they have been struggling. You know, that may change in 2024, but struggling to get Roctavian off the ground commercially as one of the gene therapy programs for hemophilia, going through, you know, the challenges of access initially in Europe that's been, you know, slower than expected. And they lowered their Roctavian guidance quite substantially for 2023, and I guess we'll have to wait for 2024 to see some momentum there. Another interesting update that I saw, among lots and lots of interesting updates in the industry, Incyte disclosed a JAK2 V617F mutant selective inhibitor program very early on in development, but this is the mutation that is underlying many of the myeloproliferative disorders that, you know, for now have been treated with, quote, pan-JAK, I mean, sometimes selective JAK or JAK1 or JAK2 or a mix thereof inhibitors, but not mutant selective. And so they're really interesting to see how this program evolves. I'm surprised that this is the first we're hearing of one of these, given how obvious it is to try it as a mutation driver for these conditions. But on the other hand, you know, there are benefits to JAK1 inhibition that go beyond the mutant. JAK1 inhibition, as we've seen in the immunology setting, has immune suppressive effects, and that can be very good for myelofibrosis, which is an intense inflammatory type malignancy. And then on the JAK2 side of the equation, for patients with polycythemia vera, JAK2 actually adds an extra kick for reducing elevated red blood cells and normalizing them. So definitely an interesting program to watch. Caught my eye as one of those. I'm surprised it took this long to get a selective mutant inhibitor in development for these diseases. And we'll see if it'll give Incyte a whole new lease on life for their franchise.
Just great point, Josh. I did not pick up on that. As you explained, I'm like, oh yeah, that's like a big deal. Cool.
It is a target that we looked at from a molecular dynamics perspective at one point, and I'll just say we were less surprised at how hard it appeared to be. Great for Incyte that they've got one, but it's a very geometrically difficult target.
So Amgen wrote down a drug that they picked up in their $900 million acquisition of Tenet Bio 2 years ago. This update led to a $650 million net impairment charge. Brian, you wanted to talk about that?
I cover Amgen, and it's interesting. It's been a interesting target, PSMA for prostate cancer and utilization of bispecifics. It's really had a rough road. Amgen, I think this is the second iteration of a PSMA by CD3 that they've gone through and discontinued. And they're a little vague about it, but there's been a number of sort of setbacks in that specific target in bispecifics. Regeneron also, although they're not CD3, they use the co-stim CD28. Earlier this year, George Yancopoulos was talking about their bispecific as potential cure, and the data was really pronounced. And then they combined it with PD-1 antibodies and led to a bunch of toxicity issues. And that's sort of been has not been sidelined. They're developing it in monotherapy, but it seemed to be a pretty tough target specifically to try to tune in the immunomodulatory side of things, run into a lot of immunological side effects, where other ways of targeting PSMA that sort of don't involve the immune system have worked pretty well. Novartis with their radiotherapeutic Pluvicto is now approved, looks very good as a monotherapy. So it's been a very interesting indication to sort of watch bispecifics develop. Obviously, I've seen a lot of success in bispecifics in sort of the B cell lineage indications like large B cell lymphoma or multiple myeloma. But in some of the larger in some of the solid tumors, it's been a little bit more hit or miss, and PSMA has certainly not found its footing in terms of a therapeutic index with this modality yet.
Great. Well, we're almost at time. I will invite you guys to make any closing remarks that you'd like to make. Maybe Tim, you could talk a little bit about what you see happening on the macro side, if you have any crystal ball. And I'll take to heart your request for a theme song. I don't remember who that was, Brian or Matt or Josh, but we will actually send it out to the audience. If anybody has any ideas for a theme song we can play the beginning at the end of each show, we'll welcome that. So, and Matt, this is your third time, I think, on our show. So I think you're officially a co-host, and we should get your picture up there. So thank you again for joining us. Thanks to everyone. And I'll invite my co-host to make closing remarks.
Yeah, so this was an important week because it was the first time we had an FOMC meeting where the Fed Chairman Jay Powell got up and didn't scare the market. When I say first time last, 3, 4, 5 months. So, every time the man speaks, the market kind of goes into a bit of freakout mode. So the market's up this week, and it's the first time we've seen that in a good while. So my conversation this week with numerous investors and market participants, the question is, okay, so now what? And my own view is we need to see Powell do this one more time. If the next meeting goes well, the inflation numbers are okay, I think we will start to see this sector turn. It's going to be a long, slow turn in 24. I'd love to tell you it's just going to shoot right up. I think it's going to be a while because, as I said, funds are in trouble, and funds are going to need some time to repair and rebuild their LP bases.
Yeah, I was going to say it's funny. I mean, the last 2 weeks has really been like the trough on sector sentiment, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, people just have been really depressed, and for the last few months, I think a lot of people have been talking about, oh, can Sarepta with Embark save the sector and create the sort of rebound on innovation if they can really cure these kids. Ironically, Embark came out, and every day since then, the XBI has been up, and not due to the success of Embark, obviously, much more to do with the macro scene, which kind of drives the market. But it's nice to see, and hopefully we could see some continuation of it next week, because certainly I've never felt the negativity in the sector that I sort of felt in October from investors.
Yeah, I think this is the best time to make to make money in biotech that I've seen perhaps throughout my entire career.
My only comment, which is going to sound pessimistic, is I feel like you can only tell a trough well after the fact. So I don't know. I feel like this fall has beaten into me a wait and see approach. So let's wait and see.
Yep. And hopefully the geopolitical situation will get better and we'll be in a better place in the world events as well. So that's also been kind of a big overhang and concern over the last month, basically. So thank you to everyone. I wish you all a great weekend, and we'll see you all next week on Biotech Hangout.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.